Hello, and welcome to the Love Me a Vita podcast, sponsored by FemPharma. I'm Jerry DiPiano, founder and CEO. Thank you for joining us as we discuss all aspects of women's healthcare. Please note, this podcast is for educational purposes only. Always refer to your healthcare practitioner for personal advice. Hi, Dr. Juliana Hauser. How are you this morning?
I'm wonderful. So good to see you.
Nice to see you. Today, we're going to speak about a topic that is near and dear to both of our hearts. And it's about mindfulness, compassion, and self-compassion. That really didn't start with a group of monks traveling 2,300 miles, but it sort of reminds us that these are important in our lives and we need to build skills around those. But I want to first start with this journey, the walk for peace. So what is the walk for peace?
Yes. So I had this video come across my feed talking about these monks that were starting a walk, that they were in Texas and were going to be walking to DC. And it caught my eye, and I kept looking at their route, and they had some really interesting rules. And they're about 15 to 19 monks that have their monastery that's set in Texas. And they are from Vietnam, but their location is in Texas currently. And as I started researching more about them and about what it means when monks go on a walking pilgrimage, a lot of ways people describe it is that the statement that they are saying is there is a disturbance in our peace. There's a disturbance in the culture, and the way that they are going to address this is to walk. And then as they got more publicity, I saw that there are places where there are big crowds. And as I was watching their route, I saw some things that I thought were really fascinating. One was they made a rule that there's no live feed of them walking. And part of that decision was that they wanted people who, in essence, were making the effort, like the people who were supposed to be there, who were making the effort to be there. You had to do a little work to figure out where they were. And that was one of their ways of kind of ensuring that kind of the right people either organically came upon their path or could plan for it. When they stopped for lunch and dinner, they increasingly were doing live feeds of that. And they were teaching meditation, they were teaching mindfulness, they were teaching, their belief of how to have a more peaceful, calm existence in the world. So they weren't talking about anything political. They weren't getting specific about what was happening in the world. They were teaching just the basics. And it was really interesting because another part of the premise of being a monk is that they don't ask for anything, and they can only receive. So they would wake up and they had a basic route of where they were going, and they had people, handlers, that were helping them do it, but no one was allowed to ask. So they were going to different churches, going to different community centers, but they didn't know. They didn't know what they were going to encounter, who they were going to encounter, if people were going to be accepting of them, if they weren't. They didn't know what food they were going to have. They didn't know where they were going to be staying. It all was given to them. And there's so, that was so moving to me to realize how much tolerance for ambiguity that you have to have if you are walking like this and relying on the goodness of humanity when a lot of us are struggling to see a lot of goodness in humanity. They had an abundance of it, and they were right. They have been met and on their journey every single day, and had places to stay and to sleep, and were being fed. And watching that was just really incredible. They also had negativity. They had, one of the monks was hit by a car and ended up losing his leg. They have this wonderful dog that everyone became very obsessed with.
And Loka.
Yes. And he was like really their beloved companion, and especially the leader, the one that was the monk that was walking in the front. He was walking a lot. So he ended up having some injuries and had to stop along the way. And they couldn't ask for his vet care. People had to volunteer for that. And of course, people did step up for that. And I, I just, as again, as I watched as a bystander on social media, I loved seeing that people were really responding well to the concept of not being asked, but just being able to give. It felt so wonderful to see that by not asking, people showed up. They knew that there was a need and they wanted to give because they wanted to give. And that gave people a way to show up in the ways that they could, big and small. Another thing that they had is that they did blessings through bracelets, and I actually have on two of them and I'll talk about that, but this one and this orange one, and people would donate yarn for them, and they would make the bracelets at night or during their breaks, and then give them out, and people would give them flowers, or they'd give people flowers. And so sometimes at the places where they had their lunch or the dinner, people donated flowers because they knew they liked to give them, especially to children. And there were just beautiful footage of the monks receiving or giving flowers as they were walking or as they were about to leave to go on the walk. And that was such a small gesture, but when you see the reactions that they would receive or when they would give it, it was just truly profound. There are some people who really embraced them and some who did not. And the leader spoke about it a couple of days later. And his reaction was just so different than most Americans would respond. He said when this man was yelling at him, and he had another incident where somebody was revving their car, threatening them to hit them with their car. He said he just smiled. He just smiled at them, and he didn't meet them with their anger. And he had like just a true understanding. I've spent a lot of time in the mindful spaces, and I've been around people who are really in practice, which is different than like the everyday person who is, you have to live your life, you have to be doing all the things with work or your family. And when you're around somebody who does that amount of mindfulness work on a daily basis, they truly just have a different vibration to them. It's palpable. When he told his story, I think in some ways it feels unbelievable, or it feels like it's a movie script that someone could easily conjure a smile and peace when you might get run over. It's very genuine, and it's a very genuine part of the practice of even just that the belief of if it's something I can't worry about, then why worry? And if it's something that I can do something about, why worry? And they just adopt this belief constantly of there's no sense, there's no good in being worried whether you're just about to be hit by this car or your foot hurts and you have to walk today or you don't know where you're going to eat. Why worry? You'll deal with it when you get there or when it comes. And we have a culture that does not embrace that. And it certainly doesn't teach that. So I felt myself quite drawn to what the monks were doing and why they're making the choices they're making. So I'll stop there before I talk about my own experience.
It's interesting. It was really embraced, not just by individuals who believe in Buddhism or Islam or Catholicism. It was really an ecumenical exercise. Or for many people who don't believe in religion, it was a really much needed opportunity for them. Why do you think that is? Why now?
Well, I think we are desperate to see that there's good in the world and good in humanity, and that we are, especially in America, but not just America, there's just so much unrest in our souls and so much fear about what humans are capable of doing that we can't handle that level of angst on a daily basis. But we also don't have a lot of guidance and leaders who are showing us a different way of being in the world when we can't control what's happening in the bigger sense of the world. And they were saying, we're doing it one foot in front of the other. We're doing it one person. We are doing it 1 minute. And I think when you have someone who is literally walking the talk, but also teaching you, and you can do this too. You can do this. It's profound. We are in a time period that has so much unrest that people don't know where to find safety. And in the end, really, safety comes from within. And we have example after example throughout history of even in the worst and most egregious of times and experiences, the people who make it out and are able to talk about it and have not lost all of themselves in that process, there is some form of mindfulness that has gotten them through it. And we forget it. Our culture as humans, we forget that that is it's such a beautiful way to, in my opinion, and I don't want to say anything against anyone's religion, but in my view, I think so much of many religions is saying the very similar thing, just differently through prayer. Like there's a lot of similarities between praying and meditating. The words are different and the context is different, but the science behind both is very similar of how it's actually affecting your brain and why it's such a peaceful thing. It's just people's exposure and entry points to those two different pathways makes a difference. But in the end, there's a lot of overlap between the two and why people are getting such goodness. And I just think people are desperate for tools. They're desperate for hope and they're desperate for tools.
You know, we didn't really speak about the women's connection, although there's a lot in the feminist press about the woman's connection to the March for Peace. Why now? Why this message? What is the message and how it's resonating with women? What is your perspective on that?
I think it does vary. I've heard different points of view from women of why it's doing it. One of them is seeing a group of men who are nonviolent and are not attention seeking, and they're not against getting attention. They have a Facebook page that's saying this. They're not trying to keep this secret, but it's not about them, and it's also all about them, and it's not being weaponized, it's not dangerous. And I think when women feel safe around men, it alters you because it just changes the way you get to show up too, and it changes your ability to be vulnerable when you don't have to be on guard. And their walk is not objectifying women, it's not using women, it is, there's a purity of what the point of their walk is. And I don't think women get to experience that very often as well.
There has been a period more recently where we talk about hegemonic masculinity. And perhaps this, again, I'm not a psychologist like you are, Dr. Juliana, but perhaps that's what women crave more than anything else. It's this power and control and pounding of chests. And, sometimes we joke about testosterone poisoning and seeing these gentle men, not gentlemen, gentle men. Is something that as women we appreciate. These are, it's not about masculine or feminine or blue or red. It's really about goodness and peace and kindness without asking for it. So we didn't ask these guys to do this. They just decided that this is something we needed right now.
Yes. And I want to be clear. I've said I got to experience them. There's a gentleness about their energy, but there's a fierceness about their presence. And I think that is unusual for women to, I mean, it's usual for men to experience, but it's unusual for women to experience a man that is approachable, but also whole into himself, which also makes him a lot safer. When a man isn't whole into himself, that's often why, one of the reasons why he's so dangerous to women. But I mean, to understand that these men were walking this far of a distance every single day, and there's an RV, so if they were hurt, they could rest in it. But in general, their job, what they were doing, was to walk every single day. I mean, I know I've walked 2 hours and I felt tired. I cannot imagine walking daily like that. And there were times they weren't wearing shoes. The fierceness that comes from that commitment to that means that you have a strength. And what you do with that strength, inner strength and physical strength, is also the litmus test for women. And when what they used was just to keep going, it was for the greater good of this, and instead of again, like trying to achieve something or a race or anything like that, I think women are very drawn to that as well. I also think Part of why they were doing this is something that women understand naturally too, that together we're better, and that the, like you said, like the thumping at your chest is not the way to enact change. And drawing people to you instead of demanding that people hear you is something that I think a lot of women respond well to.
It's the might doesn't necessarily make right, and it's that tender and toughness that women appreciate, because we know we are those individuals. We are tender and tough. We know how to birth a child, or to care for a child or an elderly parent, and we also know how to and then to be strong in the moment, and we also know how to be tender at the same time while we are taking that responsibility and giving that care. So I think it is in our DNA, and we get it. And perhaps that's why it did resonate so much with women. We did see a lot of women who followed the monks, found out where they were, showed up for them, brought the flowers, pet the dog, paid for the vet visits, and so forth. So kudos to all the women listening in. It's really important. But the message of mindfulness, compassion, and self-compassion is something that really resonated with me. And I know we haven't spent a lot of time on these types of topics, and I think it is really important, particularly now, when we know that we are facing, at least in the United States, and I suspect that it can be global, especially given the current environment where there is unrest. We so desperately need to find ways in which to embrace mindfulness, compassion, and self-compassion. And I want to make a distinction between compassion and empathy, but you're better at doing that. So let's explore that a bit.
And those are really important words because they get used interchangeably a lot. And what the difference really is the pool in which they're drawn from and the multiple perspectives of it all. Being able to have empathy for somebody else as opposed to like sympathy is that you're able to put yourself in someone else's position. You're able to think what they would feel, and you're able to hold multiple truths at once. And compassion is very, it has, it's a cousins to empathy. But some people distinguish them between empathy has more potential for action, and compassion is like a holding of space between the two. And there's a lot of people who think they're very different. Other people think they're the exact same. There's a lot of discourse about what these two things are. Professionally, we talk a lot about compassion being a foundation for empathy. And that's really my come from in a lot of places, that if you need to be able to have compassion that is feeding your empathy for others. It is a source in yourself that you have to renew. It doesn't just renew itself automatically. And we were, talking earlier that in my profession, we just talk as therapists, but I've also done training with police officers and first responders, that there's something called compassion fatigue. We don't have the same word for empathy fatigue, but we could. And compassion fatigue is when, and I think on an everyday basis, when we can't keep watching the horrors that are happening in America or all over the world, we just run out of that pool of, I can't keep putting myself in other people's positions. I'm worn out in my own position, and there's so many things to be sad about and worried about, that we have to turn that part of ourselves off. And with empathy, again, like I was talking, there's a more of an action component to it. Empathy sometimes can be renewing when we have action that makes us feel like we're doing something. And with compassion, it's a lot more of holding space for people. And again, like that can be very draining if you don't have something that's filling you up, or you don't find the goodness of things. And in kind of going back to the monks, or in general, when you have a mindfulness practice, it is the tool of mindfulness, of meditation, Or for them, Buddhism is having your self-renewal and understanding how you fill up your own cup so that you don't have compassion fatigue, so that you can keep it. Because if you imagine, I mean, I was thinking like that time when this monk was speaking about this car that was revving the engine. And I was like, there are days that I'm like, oh, come on. Like, I'm so tired. I didn't like that lunch that they gave me. That I don't like that, whatever it is. And I'm getting this and I still have to walk, 4 more hours. Like I my compassion for him was more like empathy of like, I can't imagine, putting myself in that, or and being able to draw from this place and smile at the man. And that only comes from a place of doing this on a regular basis and drawing from that on a regular basis and learning emotional regulation on a very deep level. And when I was introduced to mindfulness and my personal life, it changed my practice. I mean, it's something that I talk with all my clients about, and it's something that I've put into my life, and it absolutely makes a difference. And I remember thinking, like, one of the first times that I was able to like have the loop between compassion and empathy and my own, sense of emotional regulation, was when I was really just understanding through my work that you just never know what someone's going through, and they may just be horrific to you in your, in their day. But when you can sit there, instead of feeling personally violated by it, but think like, oh, I guess that maybe that person's having something awful that I don't know about. That was like my first thought of like, oh, I can tap into that, whether it's true or not. I mean, that person may be just a raging, and this is who how they treat everybody. But it's not about that actual exchange, especially if it's like in traffic, or it's a momentary connection with somebody that you don't have to know the exact truth in order to know what you do next with them. It changes a lot when you give that gift to yourself. So yes, it's in essence giving them empathy, or unearned, frankly, empathy. But really, what it's doing is it's protecting your emotional regulation, and it is bringing you back to your own source. Empathy and compassion can do that as well. But it's hard to tap into if you don't understand how to feel safe and how to help yourself feel safe through a mindfulness kind of practice.
Today's episode is brought to you by Femme Pharma, supporting women's health and intimacy needs for over 20 years, because feeling your best matters. So when they talk about self-compassion, and it starts, in my mind, it starts with having self-compassion, being able to give yourself a break, so to speak, to put it in the vernacular. You're not perfect. Knowing who you are, and being okay with that. Now, if you're a jerk, maybe you want to work on that. But we think about self-compassion. How do you define self-compassion? What are the tools that you believe would help us to be more self-compassionate?
That word has been used, like self-care, self-compassion has been used interchangeably as well. Like we they're just it, a lot of ways are vague words, but what they're talking about is so important to our well-being. And so, some people bristle at the thought of like self-care and self-compassion. But the way I define self-compassion is what you would do for others, and having empathy, or seeing their own perspective, and trying to give people the benefit of the doubt. Is we, especially as women, but a lot of us humans, will give other people the benefit of the doubt, but not give ourselves. We're so hard on ourselves, and we don't tell ourselves the truth, which I also think is part of self-compassion. We either give ourselves too much credit, and we're not holding ourselves accountable to our behavior, which I think holding ourselves accountable and being authentic is part of self-compassion. That we don't have to be perfect. In fact, we're not perfect, so we need to have compassion for that. And also, we're doing our best. One of my favorite things to say is therapy is it's just hard being a human. And that statement comes from a lot of self-compassion, so that doesn't turn into self-hatred, so that doesn't turn into self-doubt. Because again, for me, our human existence is built around safety. Our biology is built around safety, and our mental health is built around safety. And if you don't have self-compassion, then your own inner world, just your own casing, is already set up to not feel safe. And so I see self-compassion as something that fills our well, and it's also a protective shield. And having a much more time to pause, because a lot of what we're doing that mindfulness helps is it helps give you a pause. And so mindfulness isn't necessarily going to make you smile and like, oh, thank you for showing me I did this wrong. Mindfulness is going to give you 10 seconds, 2 seconds to make a decision, either gutturally because it's muscle memory, or a conscious decision of how we're going to show up. And kind of going back to the other question that you had about women, I think about how many different stories women would have if more men were able to have a 2 second pause, a 10 second pause, or have some of the behaviors taken out of their toolbox, because that's the focus and that is what is revered as being a man, is someone who doesn't even have that in their toolbox. And yet they're not viewed as wimpy, because there was nothing wimpy about these monks as they were walking. In fact, I felt in quite awe of their being in their presence. And again, is it okay if I tell a story of meeting them now?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah,
I had to
absolutely.
brush off of self-compassion. It just worked out that we were able to saw the end of their talk, and then we were there when they were giving out blessings and bracelets. Eventually, they came out, and people brought flowers to give to them too, and the signs were really beautiful. And so there certainly were the cameras that is everyone has these days. But when the monks would come past, everyone, and I mean everyone, went from having this like excited to see them to joy and crying and hugging each other. It was as if they had this magic wand. And I'm telling you, if I heard myself saying this, I'm like, that is ridiculous. But it's absolutely accurate. It was like a wave of peace when they looked at you, when they walked past you, and literally strangers were hugging each other that didn't know each other. It was it, and I think what it was, what my experience, because it was when I went, I think people were so relieved to have something go well and for something to be beautiful and peaceful. And it just felt like these monks were just. They were just being them. And a lot of people have talked about there's such a different vibrational energy, and not everyone will believe or understand what that means. But once I read that, I was like, that's exactly what happened. That's to me, it was they just had this different vibrational energy that felt palpable and felt like a cloak and a blanket for everybody. And I'd already been, pretty faithful in my meditation and mindful practice, but I had started this year doing something called this 5-minute journal that I'd gotten at a speaking event. And I have been very religious about doing this. Like every single morning and night, I work in this journal. And I looked back and realized that there were differences of what I was writing and what I was grateful for, what my they have a place where you do affirmations, what you're grateful for, what would make things a great day, and what were your highlights of the day. There was definitely a shift in the way I was looking at things after I experienced it. And also, and I talk about agency, it was definitely an act of agency, and embracing ambiguity to even go see them. And I realized, I was like, I'm not sure they were, it was this like planned thing that they're like, we're going to teach them this through this decision. But when they made the decision to not make it very, very easy for people to come find them, and it, I realized that the choice that I'd made, and I literally remember where I was on the road. I was like, I'm gonna do it. It was an act of self-compassion. It was an act of, we deserve this. It's okay. It's gonna be okay. And if we can't find them, we can't find them. Like just all of that. And then it working out, and then it being so beautiful, it was like this beautiful kind of surprise experience. It worked. it worked what they were going for. And I thought, gosh, if so many people had this collective addition to this experience, how different our world would be.
So when we think about techniques, so we want to leave our guests with some techniques. We talk about mindfulness, and you talked a lot about, being grounded in something, right? Sort of separating yourself from technology and giving yourself some peace, starting off with some peace and being intentional about doing that every single day. And I think the expression they use is, today I will find my peaceful place, whatever that means to you, whether that is starting off with prayer, whether that is thinking about something that brings you joy. But let's talk about some techniques that our listeners can avail themselves of.
And their sentence is, today will be my peaceful day. And the only reason I know it, because it really resonated with me. And I write it every night. I write it in the next day's journal on the very top, so that when I go to that page, when I wake up in the morning, I see today is my peaceful day. And it's a simple sentence that's very profound. So I want to explain real quickly that the science behind mindfulness in a lot of ways is really creating neuropathways that have a positive, grounded gratitude that is emotionally regulated. And when you do that, when you have enough of those neuropathways, you again have your mind, your soul trust you and feel safe. And when you trust yourself and when you feel safe, you make better decisions. You are emotionally regulated and you have a lot more clarity and you have a lot more access to the parts of you that have the good muscles that you have access to. When you have lots of trauma, when you have lots of negativity, when it's very hard to get to the neural pathways that are the good, safety, grounded places, it makes everything harder in reaching the truth and the goodness of us. And so that's the science behind what we're talking about as well. Now, there's been lots of studies on the neuroplasticity of what happens to neurons when you're meditating. And there's some variance of how long they recommend. My training was that the ideal is to do a half an hour in the morning before 10 o'clock, and then a half an hour like 3:30, 4:30. That my life does not sustain that. It's not something that I can do. If I go to a retreat for a week, it's heaven. It's just fabulous to like to that's all I have to do. And I certainly feel very different. So they're right that it makes a very big difference, but that's not accessible for most people. So what I say is, if it's 2 minutes, if it's 5 minutes, anything is better than nothing. And you don't have to start with something so big as 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And in fact, I really often recommend that you do just start at 5 minutes. And then you just get to know yourself. Some people, the kind of the truest sense of meditation, like the way that I was trained was through doing like basically a chant, that the words are more sounds, and so that you're not associating it with thoughts. So your brain isn't being triggered. In essence, you want it to zone out. But I think for most people that's difficult unless you are in a training. So I like guided imagery, and you can go on Spotify, you can go on any platform and find just tons of meditation. You can go on YouTube and do it. And so I do recommend guided meditation. You just have to find a voice that you like. And there's often morning meditations, there how to go to sleep meditations, and then there's everything in between that you any topic you could just do love meditation and you'll find 40 of them. And again, as long as you are okay, you like the voice, then the message doesn't nearly honestly matter as much because you're just zoning into and tuning into the sound. And sometimes the message is powerful, and that's what I'll keep it with me that day, a sentence that I heard. But really, what it is I am teaching my body, my brain, that I'm not attuning to the stress in my life. I am tuning into safety. I am experiencing safety no matter what. And that is really what is the importance of getting behind a mindful practice. Anything else on top of that is just cherry on top. And sometimes we didn't need the cherry on top. But really, what you need is consistency so that your brain it has a break, and has a chance to be building the muscle of those beautiful grounded neuropathways. So that's one thing. Like guided meditation is something that I really recommend. I've always loved the idea of journaling, and I talk to people about journaling. I teach them as a therapist to do journaling. I am not somebody who's ever, I have, when I have found like childhood like diaries, it's like, dear diary. And then 2 pages later, it's blank for the rest of the diary. So I've just never been somebody that could do that. There are people who can, and that in and of itself is a form of meditation, to journal, to get your thoughts out. I had this book that is called the 5 minute meditation. I love it. It's very accessible for the busy person. And the page starts with, what are you grateful for? Three things that you're grateful for. Three things that will make your day great, and two affirmations. And then what were the three highlights of your day? And what did you learn? Two things that you learned. That's it. It takes me no time at all to go through it. And then I get it set up for the nighttime. And at nighttime, I get it set up for the morning, and I put it right by my bed. And what I've said to myself is that self-discipline is self-love. And I want to love myself more. So I'm having the discipline to keep doing this. And there's not much that I've been able to keep up twice a day in the past few years. And I have been incredibly consistent for many months on it, and I absolutely know it's making a difference in my life. And I don't look back very often at it, but I have a couple of times. And as I said earlier, I see a big difference in two different ways. And it's in the early time, I kind of was looking for things to be grateful for. Now it's just like, how do I pick up a few? And why, there's a lot that's easily bad. Why not put the time towards the good? It truly makes a difference. It's worth it. And even just a couple minutes a day makes a difference in your life.
We talk about mental muscle, and there's actually really great science, as you said. They've shown that there are changes that happen in the prefrontal cortex, the amygdala. So that's a whole podcast. But check out some techniques for mindfulness. If you're the type of person like I am that believes that you have to read to, satisfy yourself, lots of great books. We'll be talking about that on the next podcast. But start with mindfulness, help that brain and that mental muscle to change, literally change. And then, secondarily, practice self-compassion, because if you're not self-compassionate, it makes it really challenging to feel that compassion for others. Many more conversations to come. Dr. Juliana Hauser, thank you so much
Thank you,
for
Mary.
spending time with me again today. Dr. Juliana Hauser is a psychologist and a certified sex therapist and a certified menopause sexual therapist. She can be found at drjuliana.com, and she takes clients from around the country and around the world. So check her out if you need more from her. And we could always be using more of Dr. Juliana Hauser. Thank you so much for being part of the Mia Vita podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you for joining us on the Love Mia Vita podcast. Love Mia Vita means love my life, and that is a mantra we should all live by. Please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and remember to follow us on social media and on fempharma.com. Thank you, and be well.